स्टेज सरस्वती देवी गुरु भनेको चरणी विशेष शून्य बारे प्रशिक्षणदेश गर्ने सो वी लाइक टु वेलकम ब्याक हिज होलिनेस भक्तिविधि पूर्ण महाराज श्री भक्तिविधि पूर्ण महाराज की जय सेभिङ माई लाइफ I happen to be in such a flamed up stage of consciousness right now. I think I just got to turn it all over tomorrow. Right? So what we said yesterday is we just start this. Maharaj, we said we just start to, as usual, and give the students a chance you know, to go through this class and get some inspiration from that and from their own reading, then select topics in this expanded new week. Did you get a chance to look at this?
Yeah, I had that list.
Yeah, so.
And then also the, the definitions.
And then this should begin hopefully even already today, but certainly day after tomorrow, informing us of what they'd like to give their presentations on, and we'll schedule that. But we can start as usual. So please, Maharaj.
Just start reading, so?
Yeah, you have to start today.
Okay. Right then. Did everybody understand these terminologies that were here that Maharaj used? All these Sanskrit terms? Yeah? Oh, not everybody got them. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it has to be redistributed.
Okay, so then who didn't get yesterday? The students give it everything out now. Because we were using, to make things clear, because the Sanskrit padati is very, very clear and very organized. So then in discussions we came up with traditional terms. All these terms are traditionally used, and how we're using them is how they're traditionally used. Like that. So it's that you have a chapter summary which just gives a very short indication of what's there. It's not talking about the verses or anything, just the overview, just like Prabhupada, what he does in the later cantos.
Fifth canto
he starts. So like that. Then after that, then you have the, or you give something where you give a logic behind it, examples, and all these things like this. This is all part of the presentation, Panchanga Nyaya. Nivesha then will be somewhere it's just stuck in there. You'll see is that it's a note that will bring out. It's not like a full delineation. It's just something that will make things clear or connect it to something else, reference it, or things like that. So you'll see that. Shloka Anusaranam will be the essence of the shlokas. Shloka Anusaranam, the sara, the essence, like that. Then appendix, that's, we know appendix just means things that are connected but not quite relevant for, not say relevant, let's say it's like this. Prabhupada, the way he's writing it is very clear, but at the same time he says everything's in his books. Right? So that's like the Veda. Everything is in the Veda. But to make it clear, then it is compiled into the four Vedas. Does that make some sense? So there's a main theme that the chapter is giving. There's a main theme in the purport that's going through. But because the shlokas touch on various subject matters, and the Bhagavatam being the essence of all subject matter, then you're going to have points that are indirectly connected to this subject matter that are important Vedic knowledge in that. It may be explained more later on, but it's there and it gives a connection. So the appendix will carry all of those different things. So that will include the vinodakams, means points of interest. Like it's talking on one thing and we're discussing about that Sukadeva Goswami, he just left and went to the forest without going through the Upanayanam ceremony. Prabhupada may get into that and the importance of the samskars, you know, for family life and this and that. The verse is actually pointing out that he's a Paramahamsa. He's not connected with the material endeavor. That's the point that's being made. But because it's used as an example, the varnashram aspect of samskars, it's an important element. So then Prabhupada takes the opportunity to speak, but that's not the flow of the point, the theme. So the Shloka Anusaranam is taking out of the chapter, Prabhupada's the shlokas and the shlokas, of course, but the purports that are in connection with that theme, so we get a very clear idea of what is the theme. Then in the Parishishtam, in the appendix, then Maharaj brings out very important points that are connected to the theme but aren't actually the theme itself. So that's how you'll notice this study is like that. So we don't want to lose anything, but we want to separate it so we know exactly this chapter is saying this point. But it also makes these side points because nothing is just exact. You know, you make one point, but everything's connected. So then, does that make some sense? Okay. And vritti then means comments that the author himself, means Sauta Maharaj, he is pointing out from his own understanding, bringing in examples from here and there and that. Does that make sense? So you have all these different kinds. So these are all very traditional methods that are used by the acharyas when they deal with the scriptures and all that. So if you familiarize yourself, then it'll be easy because not only you'll find it in here, especially so fully, because Bhagavatam contains everything, but in any of the other courses that we offer, you'll also find these words being used in these methods. Does that make sense? Okay. So, 11th chapter. No questions. That means no one should ask any questions. First chapter 11. No questions. Okay. Adhyaya Prakash, Lord Krishna's entrance into Dwarka. Having departed Hastinapura, Sri Krishna journeys with his royal entourage to his own capital, Dwarka. The citizens gather before the Lord to offer prayers. The Lord accepts their offerings. Krishna enters the city, greets more citizens, and exchanges affection with his mothers. Finally, the Lord enters into each of his 16,108 palaces and sees each of his queens. The transcendental character of the Lord and the spiritual nature of Krishna's relationships with his queens are described. So you see, a very important thing is here is Maharaj made a break here in the study, you know, up to the 10th, because up to this point, from the 7th, right? Then Krishna, like, appears.
Yes.
But he's not the main character. He's there. He is the main character, but at the same time, as the devotees are taking prominence. Yeah. But here,
the devotees are declaring him to be the
main thing. Main thing.
Yeah.
The MC, yeah.
With that caste, and we start to hear from them that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this chapter 11 is actually where Krishna Leela begins in the Srimad Bhagavatam.
In other words, before we're seeing the character of the devotees, their dependency upon the Lord, their cleverness, how they view things. You know, it's very different. Kunti is what is connected to the Lord, that's what's nice. And what's not connected to the Lord is not nice. So they're in the forest, they're going through miseries, but Lord is there, that's nice. Being now emperors of the world, having all facility that you could ever possibly any human being can imagine, that's not nice, because Krishna's not there. Different perspective. You know, or Arjuna, what is the pragmatic way of getting something done? Is this Ashwatthama Leela is Vedic pragmatism. He has to please Bhima, and he has to please Draupadi. Right? And they both have support. Draupadi has support of Yudhishthir, Bhima has support of Krishna. So it's not something he can just do a little niti and do a little talking and get out of it. Yes, so pragmatic means what actually gets the thing done and maintains the relationships. This is what's being brought in here. And with this chapter, is Krishna's relationships. That's what's Krishna's relationship, right? He is Sat. It means in the deities, he is Sat. Eternality means everything's based on him. Balaram is Chit, Radharani is Ananda. Right? It means they have all, but I'm just saying they're the deities of them. So relationship has to be established. So Arjuna had to solve the problem and maintain all the relationships. It's not just what gets it practically done, for artha, you know, economics. That's the modern. It, practical means it gives material result. But here, the Vedic is, practical means it maintains all the relationships. And then if you do that, artha will naturally come. If people like you, they're favorable, you always get facility. But if people don't like you, even you got the money today, you won't have it tomorrow. Does that make sense? So, very different. So then here we see is that Krishna then, in this entering Dwarka, the whole thing is simply interaction with devotees. So that's Krishna. Shloka Anusarana. Srila Suta Goswami tells the sages of Naimisharanya that after reaching his own country, the kingdom of the Anartas, Lord Krishna at last arrived at Dwarka's outskirts. There he sounded his conch shell, the Panchajanya, to herald his arrival. Because you don't want to be taken by surprise. It's like an interaction means you have the most ideal thing. It's just like, give an example. In the tradition, a man, even in his own house, will not walk into the area where ladies are without making a sound. Every man has what it is, a cough, something, clearing the throat. They all have it because the interaction is such that you know the person's coming, you can prepare, and then the interaction will be at its best. Well, if you just walk in, it won't. So traditional house, they always do that. They're walking into anywhere where the ladies are, they'll always make a sound. And then they know they're coming, yes.
Yeah, just in this connection, I mean, this is really a digression from the point.
Vinodika.
Yeah, you're right, this is real Vinodika. But I'd like to just briefly tell you about a book I read, I happened to find in Delhi years ago. It was written, it was a republication of a book that an Indian woman wrote about her life in the 1800s, during the British rule. And she was describing her girlhood, and she grew up in such a traditional house. And, you know, sometimes you hear in our ISKCON discussion, you know, all these, sometimes you get little heated discussions about position of woman, and someone comes along and starts to talk about, well, you know, what the Vedic position of woman, you know, practically Shudra, this, that, you know, and, but she described in very picturesque language what her life was like as a girl. And the house is built like a, sort of like a fort, actually. There's an outer walled region, just like here in Mayapur, and that's where the men live. Mm-hmm. And that's to give protection to the women who live in the inside. And the women had their own quarters, and in the center they had their own pukur, their own swimming pool. She described how as a girl she was always swimming with her friends, and you know, they were having, I mean, it was amazing, you know, having so much fun and singing songs, and then the older ladies would come and teach them all the pujas and the vratas, and they would, the girls, it was just like a gurukul, but inside the house. And so these little girls would learn from a very small age, you know, all the holy days and what to do. And otherwise, they're having, you know, she was really, she was describing how happy she was, having so much fun. I mean, they had their own swimming pool. And just like you said, the men, they stayed on the outside, on the outer quarters, and actually, they would, I mean, only in case of some emergency or something would they ever enter. Generally, even the husband, the father, even he would not come, you know, casually into that area. Yeah, only if there was some need, some emergency, some real need, then the men would come in there. So it was a, the women had their own place, and I mean, very clearly you could see from reading this book, she really, she was so fondly remembering her life as a girl. So this, you know, this dark, morbid picture that we sometimes draw of woman's role in Vedic culture is totally, you know, it's
misrepresented.
Yeah, it's a total misrepresentation.
Yeah. Yeah,
So okay. We see here, so Krishna blows the conch, because if he just walks in, no one's prepared. They want to give their best. So he blows the conch, then everybody's ready. They know Krishna's here. They make a little arrangements. You'll see that then he'll very slowly, carefully come in, you know, so that those who have less arrangements are there for, you know, and depending on the intensity of the emotions, those who appreciate will be there first. Those at servitorship will be there next. Those of friendship will be next. It'll just keep going like that. So you see then, and at the end then is the queens. Like that. The pure white conch seemed reddened by the touch of Krishna's lips, so that it appeared like a white swan playing in the stems of red lotus flowers. Nivesha, in purport 3 means the verse 3. Verse 3 purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, just as the gopis in Vrindavan used to think of Krishna while he was away from the village for cowherding engagements, the citizens of Dwarka were all immersed in thought of the Lord while he's away from Dwarka to attend the battle of Kurukshetra. I hear it probably make cowherding. Yeah, it creates his own language. His divine grace adds, by ardent love and devotional service to the Lord, or in other words, by spiritual contact with the Lord, everything becomes spiritually reddened like the conch shell in the grip of the Lord. And the Paramahamsa, or the supremely intelligent person, plays the part of the ducking swan in the water of spiritual bliss, eternally decorated by the lotus flower of the Lord's lotus feet. So we see here is the technical points are there, just so we know what the relationship is. It means knowledge is to understand the relationship, but actually the taste of that relationship is what is to be appreciated. Right? So here we see is just as the gopis are thinking in this way, also the residents of Dwarka are thinking this way. But one is he's out in the field with the cows and that. The other is he's at a battle, he's doing his kingly duties. But it's the same feelings like that.
And so the language Prabhupada uses is so, yeah. I mean, cannot be compared to any of the literature. To bring out that rasa.
Yeah. And to seamlessly flow from rasa to tattva that you don't even notice the difference. That's the uniqueness. Because you pick up an academic book, it's obviously academic. You know, it's like very dry. You know? Or you know, sahajiyas will do things and it's very, very sentimental. But Prabhupada could move in and out. It's like a child. It's so pure and just so clear the knowledge is given in such essence that it doesn't seem academic, though great scholars can't even explain it. It means it can't, you know, it's just devotees themselves are bewildered by the actual points being made. But they're so simple that you think, okay. But many times it's so deep, the meanings. And at the same time, you can then move into Krishna's pastimes, but in such a way it's so pure and simple and light that it's very accessible. It doesn't have all that, you know, deep kind of like trying to churn the emotion and all that kind of thing. It's just very, very sweetly, because Krishna in his pastime, it's pure. So it has that lightness, that child. It probably gives the example of a child playing with themselves in the mirror. That's Radha and Krishna. You know, a child just sees themselves in the mirror. There's no strange, there's no lust, there's no, just like that. So the same way Radha and Krishna interact. It's just that pure and that transparent. So it was just an appreciation of Prabhupada's. Continuing, having long endured the transcendental pain of separation from Krishna, when the citizens of Dwarka heard the transcendental sound of their Lord Shankar, they rushed quickly out the city gates to have a long-awaited darshan of the Lord. As they came before Lord Krishna, the residents of Dwarka presented him with gifts while welcoming him in ecstatic language. Verses 1 to 10. In truth, there had never been any question of danger to Dwarka's citizens, even while Sri Krishna was personally absent from the throne. Just as the underworld capital of Nagaloka, named Bhogavati, is protected by fearsome celestial serpents, Dwarka was similarly protected by famous warriors like Bhoja, Madhu, Arha, Kukura, Andaka, and other fierce yet noble Kshatriyas who were as strong as Lord Krishna himself. Nivesha. That the capital of Nagaloka is located below the earth's surface, where it is ever immersed in subterranean darkness, is a prosperous metropolis, illuminated by the brilliant jewels that naturally adorn the heads of the ferocious celestial servants called Nagas, is explained in purport to the 11th verse. Year-round, Dwarka's city was blessed by the opulences of all seasons simultaneously. And that's one of the things of Krishna, is that the six seasons are something to taste, because each one has something special. Like in this season, then you can put on different kinds of clothes. Warm foods are appreciated. You eat in the middle of the day. You know, the fires are nice, and anything like that. Closeness is, it's a special flavor. Well, the summer is a different thing than light clothes, breezes, cooling foods, cooling drinks, the evening time. You know, every season has its specialty. So Dwarka is so special that all six are always there. So all of them can be tasted. It was the site of countless hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and ponds from which lovely lotuses bloomed. In every residential doorway, auspicious articles such as yogurt, fruit, sugarcane, incense, lamps, and full pots of water were placed. And fruit, flowers, and unbroken seeds were strewn here and there over the ground. Upon hearing of Krishna's arrival, Vasudev, Akrura, Ugrasena, and Balaram, as well as Prajumna, Charu Deshna, Samba, and the other sons of the Lord abandoned their engagements of eating, sitting, or resting, and hastened to meet him, Nivesha. In the purport to 15th verse, Srila Prabhupada presents a short biography of each of the seven personalities named in the previous sentence. So we also see is that this is a city. You know, this is a Pakka city. It means of cities, that it's Dwarka. Right, that is the city. Everything else is expanded from there. But we see it's full of hermitages, it's cottages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, ponds. That's part of the city. It means you can't just have cement, you know. I think one of the original drawings the devotees made when Prabhupada asked that they draw up the city, and they just packed in the buildings and everything, trying to get everything in. And then Prabhupada looked at it, kind of like, where are the parks? Where's the space? Where's the, you know, humans don't live like this. This is it's like New York's, you know, for animals. It's not for humans, you know. So it's like...
jungles.
Yeah, jungle, yeah. So it's like that. So that's one interesting point, is that these things, and also these elements of auspiciousness, just create a nice atmosphere, because everybody is doing something to create a nice atmosphere. We create our house, we create everything for a nice atmosphere. And then that the devotees, because of their affection, they would give up things that are, you mentioned here, eating, sleeping, resting. You know, these are very dear to the living entity, but, you know, they would immediately drop them to go see Krishna. Then next, keeping the Brahmins and elephants in front, the Lord's male relatives rode upon their chariots, were accompanied by the sounds of bugles and the chanting of the Vedic hymns. Hundreds of famous prostitutes, all beautifully decorated, proceeded upon various vehicles, for they were very eager to see the Lord. Nivesha. 19th purport is especially well known among Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam purports. Here he makes it understandable to the modern reader a rather controversial aspect of the Vedic social order. Even the prostitutes were granted a degree of public respectability. Moreover, such women were often celebrated devotees of the Lord. His Divine Grace relates in this purport the narrative of Bilva Mangal Thakur and the beautiful courtesan Chintamani, who became the Thakur's Vartma Pradarshak Guru. Because it's a different concept. In other words, in a social function, because social means basically you're talking grihastas, pretty much. But in a social function, then women are very important. What they add. When a woman is happy, everybody's happy. When the women are sad, everybody's sad. So this principle, happy women taking part in the festival, is a very important element in the culture. But the, traditional women, the protected women, wouldn't do it. So you had to have women doing that, so that's the prostitutes. So that's the main element of the prostitutes, is that they will take part in public displays where a trained woman would never do. She won't come into public. She doesn't garland the guests. She doesn't show them their seat. She doesn't sit there and fan them. or, you know, host around, or, you know, do all these things that are nice that, you know, that people appreciate. You know, big guests come and the ladies come and greet them and take them and sit them and give them things to drink and do all that. The cultured women wouldn't do. They have their families and all that. But it's necessary. Therefore, the prostitutes would do that. That would be the... Yes.
Yeah, for in Vedic culture, of course, the high-class women, the highest class of woman was known. Prabhupada mentions Surya Napashati. She was not even seen by the sun. Mm-hmm. If she would go out, she would be in a palanquin, all enclosed, carried by her servants. And, you know, we have to, because of the language we have to use this word prostitute. And actually, I also use the word courtesan, which is a older term and is actually more accurate. But I don't know how many devotees here know the meaning of that word. That's more bringing out the role these women actually played in Vedic society. Because now, when you think of prostitute today, it's, you know, streetwalker, hooker, as mm-hmm. they say. And but in, you know, there's that ruined city in southwest India. What is it, Hampi? Mm-hmm. Used to be called Vidyanagar, I think. And this was there's a famous ruins of a huge Nisringa temple, because it was a Vaishnava kingdom, the capital, that was overrun by the Muslims, I don't know, around the year 1300, 1400, something like that. And so archaeologists go there and they study, because it's an amazing archaeological site. You really see what Vaishnava culture was like in the Middle Ages in India. And one of the most widest streets in the whole site, with the most, you know, these are all ruins, but obviously the most opulent buildings, was the street of the courtesans, the prostitutes. So these women were not just there for sex. I mean, that was just one aspect. But they were, they were singers, they were dancers, they were expert in receiving guests, making them feel comfortable. They were expert in conversation. They would even know the six systems of philosophy, because if a Brahmin came, he would want to, because Brahmins would also sometimes take, you know, those more. We often talk about the materialistic Brahmins.
What's his name? Shantikama Jabala? His father was a Brahmin.
Yes.
His mother was a prostitute.
His Jabala. Mother was a prostitute. Yes, exactly. And he was accepted as a Brahmin by Gautama Rishi. So the woman would have to know how to talk to the Brahmin. So they would be expert in six systems of philosophy. They could carry on conversation at a very high intellectual level. Art for kings. They could discuss anything. I mean, we have no conception in our modern time of what kind of women these were. They were, yes, prostitutes, but
they were highly educated, sophisticated, qualified women who were not detected.
Yes.
Basically, that's
they were what we would say, you know, the liberated women of the Vedic time. So there was a place for such women, you know, those kind of women who just feel too confined to be married to one man and stay in one place. They have to be free. They have to go out. So there was actually a place for them. We unfortunately have to use this term prostitute for them now, because that's the nature of our language. But they were much, much more than that. And they were very highly respected. You can see that in these ruins of the kingdom of Vidyanagar, where they lived in the city. And what, you know, they had the nicest, among the nicest houses. And like Prabhupada writes here, famous. They would be famous throughout all the city. Prabhupada reminisced in his childhood, when he was growing up in Calcutta, that whenever there was a social function, the Mulik family, big, it means the broader Mulik family to which Prabhupada belonged, was sometimes, because they were rich, what was exactly the caste?
Suvarnavarna.
Suvarnavarna, yeah. So that's a kind of what? Between Vaishya and Brahmana or Kshatriya, right? It's a mix.
It's kind of like, from what I understand, is that it's kind of like a...
The Kayasthas are technically dwijas who take up a service. You know, like they would work for the king or that. So they might be Brahmins and this and that, but they're working pay. And then in this, then they specifically got into business.
Yes.
But their origin, generally, in this case, was probably Brahminical.
Yes, so actually, Prabhupada's, the Smulak family was very aristocratic. They so they would put on sometimes social functions. And Prabhupada, I've heard the tape myself, Prabhupada reminisced how the most beautiful, you know, we have to use this word, prostitutes, mm-hmm. were invited, paid for, they were hired to sing, to dance, and then at the end they would sit on the grass and the men would sit around them, you know, and just talk. And the men would enjoy the beauty of these, because these women were very extremely beautiful and extremely, you know, they just like movie stars, you know.
They're expert in charms.
Yeah, just expert, just like a beautiful movie actress of today. And they were famous, you know, famous personalities. So it would be an honor for a man to meet. And Prabhupada said the wives of those men would proudly tell other women that my husband has met this famous, and if even if he had a relationship with her, you know, paid to meet her later, the wife would be very proud, and she would tell the other women, my husband has been with so and so. Which is a culture we really have to like think hard to comprehend how things worked in Vedic times. But it had, you see, the Vedic culture is so wonderful. It had room for everything. Everything was there. But it was just in such a nice, peaceful and splendid manner. You know, everything done with such culture and taste, and all to cultivate the finer sentiments of the human being. Even the prostitutes were there to help men cultivate higher sentiments. You know, Prabhupada does write about that there are always men who are going to use that rather barnyard phrase, tomcat around. So then the Vedic culture would have, you know, this class of women for them.
Yeah, so
but by associating with them, they would be elevated because these women were very, very, very sophisticated. Incredible. And we see how Lord Krishna, you know, Lord Krishna, he's God, the purest of the pure. He's in the role of king, and yet he's greeting them. He's to all these different classes, he has some way of acknowledging them and smiling and exchanging greetings. And, you know, you are also a very valuable part of my social system that I'm in charge of, thanking them for their service. And so, and also Prabhupada, yeah, he did mention that all of those women that he saw in those functions that were brought, hired by the Mulak family, he said every one of them was a Vaishnavi. And they would always sing songs about Lord Krishna. And
the courtesana is the court of the king. The courtesana is the ladies who were charmed and flirt with the king.
It also means the aristocracy. You know, because in also you find, like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada uses the word king even for smaller local rulers. It doesn't just mean the emperor. Mm-hmm. But any man who had, even Nanda Maharaj,
yes,
is a kind of king, you know. Because there's a sandhi where Vaishyas gain the power and authority approaching that of Kshatriyas. So practically, Nanda Maharaj was the king of the cowherd men, and above him there was Maharishi Vrishabhanu, who was the actual Kshatriya. And they had their relationship was more like that than a relationship of, you know, master and servant. They were friends. Because the upper level of Vedic Vaishya is very, very close to Kshatriya. So they would actually have more like an equal relationship. So, yeah, I use that word courtesan because in that sense, any powerful aristocratic men would be able to employ the services of such women. So the Mulick family was a very powerful family in the early part of the 20th century when Prabhupada was a small child.
I mean, originally they owned the whole
time. Due to bad management, they sold it off. But you know, the whole thing of Charnak, you know, put it all together. There were three villages. He came up with the concept to make it all one, make it a city rather than villages. But all the land was owned by the Mulicks. They owned everything. So then slowly, you know, due to lack of, you know, business talents or this or that, they sold it.
The Prabhupada made a plan to take the whole world back for the Mulick family.
It's interesting, just in the thing is that of all the families, the most powerful was the Mulick family, you know, and that most aristocratic.
Then within that, then of Calcutta, the most developed plate was Mahatma Gandhi Road. And of Mahatma Gandhi Road, if you go there and look, just that right next to where Prabhupada's house was, they have these big, huge, now they're turned into fruit markets and that, and they're like one of the funkiest places in Calcutta. But if you look at the architecture and the space, it was probably the most aristocratic place on Mahatma Gandhi Road. That's where Prabhupada appeared. So it's like, you know, and of all places in the world, then India, of India, Bengal, you know, and in Bengal, then, you know, we had here Calcutta was the city.
Yeah.
You know,
British called Calcutta the jewel of the empire.
Yeah. Yeah. City of palaces, like that. So you couldn't have got better than that. Yeah. You know, it's like that.
You need to wash the floor with rose water.
Wash the floor with rose water.
Yeah.
Not Durga Puja start without the dirt of a courtesan house. They had to bring the dirt of the courtesan house to start the Durga Puja.
Yeah, they work everybody.
That's interesting.
There's a nice story, you know, and I heard the traditional Bengali story from Bhakti Churu Maharaj about courtesan prostitute, her house, living in a fine house on one side of the street. On the other side of the street, there was a ritualistic brahmana. And this brahmana was always doing all his pujas and vratas and everything. And when he was done, he would sit on his veranda and he would see the men going to the house of the prostitute across the street. And then he would make a loud noise of disgust. And he would take a stone from the ground, and he would, he had a pile of stones. He would add another to the pile. He said, another sin this woman has committed. Just see how many sins. And so as years went by, the pile became bigger and bigger and bigger. Meanwhile, the woman, because she was a devotee of the Lord. So, because prostitution in that was a caste, the Vaishya, it was actually a subcaste of the Sudras. So if you're born into, if your mother is a Vaishya, you become a Vaishya. Your mother trained you, you see. And it was a rigid system. There was not much opportunity for a woman to leave that occupation. She would even be known by the name, you know, that she belongs to this caste. So
sometimes
she,
kings would marry them.
Yeah, sometimes it might happen. But generally, you know, born in that, that's your karma, and of course the Vedic outlook is to accept your karma and act within that role. So whenever a man would come to her door, she would go to her deity of Krishna and light incense and make a prayer. My dear Lord, I'm sorry, this is my karma. I have to commit yet another sin, but I beg you to forgive me. And in this way, you know, she lived her life.
she was always, although having to do that, she was always, you know, praying to Krishna to kindly accept her service and forgive her. So then it just so happened that at the both the Brahmana and the woman, the time of death came to both of them at the same moment. And the Brahmana, because of all the rituals, paka ritualistic yagyas he had done, all the mantras he had chanted, all the books he had studied, you know, all the things he had done, vratas he had observed. So he was expecting he's going to rise up, you know, to Svarga or Vaikuntha. Instead, he saw in space the Yamadutas coming. And then he looked across the street and he saw the Vishnudutas coming to the house of the courtesan and putting her on the chariot very nicely. And then he began to shout at the Yamadutas, "What is this? I did all my vratas and, you know, all these ceremonies, and you're coming to take me to the Yamalaya? And why is she going to Vaikuntha?" And the Yamadutas said, "Dear sir, she died thinking of Krishna. You died thinking of her sins. So you have to take the reaction of her sins. Come with us." So this is a traditional Bengali story.
It's said that if you criticize somebody, you know, unless it's like you're in a position to correct them or teach them or that, if you criticize, then what is the fault? You take it on. The other person's relieved of it,
yeah.
Right? Because they've done something wrong. They're going to have to suffer the reaction. But you criticize them for it. They don't have to suffer the reaction. You take it. You have to suffer it. It's a little known. A little known fact, but that's
become more known in the history of ISKCON
but
in recent years.
Yeah, yeah.
That the great reformers who were not able to control their anger and their, you know, vituperative speech, even though they might have had a worthy cause in, you know, calling for some reform, but because they did it in a very rajasic and tamasic manner, then they're no longer with us. And those who they were criticizing, you know, many of them are still in their positions.
Okay. Keeping the Brahmins and elephants in front, the Lord's male relative...
You already read that, Maharaj.
Yeah, there were also numerous dramatists, singers, dancers, and learned speakers who desired to offer their respective talents for Krishna's pleasure. So here we can see is that dramatists, singers, dancers, this would probably would mean men, because if it was women, they would have they're already included with the prostitutes. Nivesha, in purport. To the 20th verse, Srila Prabhupada glorifies the creative talents of Vedic civilization. The dramatists, artists, dancers, singers, historians, genealogists, orators, and so on, who are all classified as sudras in the Varnashram social system. Because even like orators, this means they're expert at speaking. I remember once Shatadanya was telling me that they went to, I think it was the Birlas, Bajor, some of these really, really wealthy, influential, you know, aristocratic families. And they had invited the, I think, one of the top or the top orator. And he was saying, and they were speaking like on Gita or something like that, the language they used and how cleverly they put together, he says, it's so impressive. It's just so sweet, attractive and sweet, and it's just amazing. What they're saying is complete nonsense. But, you know, because they wouldn't have a clue, they're not devotees or anything. But he just says how they word it is so wonderful. He can see why these people who are so refined themselves are so attracted to this kind of, you know, presentation. So therefore, the orators would come and tell stories and, you know, give points and that. And it makes it a very nice, environment, you know. Indeed, all of the citizens came out to greet Krishna, and in turn, the Lord offered each and every one of them due respect and honor. The Lord thus greeted the various grades of persons by bowing his head, exchanging words, embracing, shaking hands, giving affectionate looks and smiles, and awarding assurances and benedictions. Like that. So that's important that Krishna would relate to everybody. One can do, but the tendency is that we'll just focus on who we know or who is there if you come into a group. But the point is it's everybody gets contact. So Krishna would do that. Everybody would get that eye contact and that look or smile or nod. And here handshake also means it's not like the Western one-handed. It means two. You hold with the one and then the other hand holds the...
Clasp.
Both hands. Yes, you clasp the hands. Because respecting with one hand is considered, that's for Shudras. So it's always two. That's why we use... two hands, you know, like that. You know, the army is one hand, the Buddhist, you know, one hand. You know, it's like that. You know. Yeah, yeah, one hand. So that's the thing. The Vedic is respect is one, but then the other is there. So they're both hands. You clasp. Yeah.
One doesn't hide a knife behind the...
Yeah, you can. Oh, yeah, I guess he says one advantage is you can't hide a knife behind your back. So. Okay. Yeah. Very, very significant. Very. Didn't think of that one. As Lord Krishna passed along the public roads, accompanied by his elderly relatives and brahmanas, the ladies assembled on the roofs of the palaces to see him, for they considered this to be the greatest festival. Right? Because everything's there for beauty, and he is beauty personified, so he'll be the greatest festival. Although the inhabitants of Dwarka were accustomed to seeing the Lord daily, since he is the reservoir of all beauty, they are never satiated.
Maharaj? Because so many attendees were not here yesterday, I think we have to go over some practical points in the last. Because this is a very nice, the Nivesha is very something we could take a whole hour to talk about. So we can wait for the next class period.
Okay.
It's a very nice point Prabhupada makes in the purport. With the reference I added from Srila Jiva Goswami.
One thing you could do to make it so it would work, so you get in all the things, is you could go through, like, let's say you take this group, like here, this 1 to 10. Some comments are made, and then anybody else who there was something in there that struck them, then they could say something, and then move to the next group of conversers. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, yeah, we have to let everyone know how we want to proceed. Yesterday, for some reason, many of you who were regular attendees didn't come. And we were reading from the comments, the feedback, and from these comments, which basically we could club them together into about three or four main concerns. So from that, we have... Well, to be honest with you, we're really looking careful at how I presented this essay. I gave suggestions of what you might want to write about, and sure enough, everybody wrote on those four things, which means it was already in my mind. So what I did was very cleverly get from you confirmation for the plan I already had. That's the way it actually worked. So then, you know, now I'm ready to do what I wanted to do anyway. Because I have democratic support. So for henceforward, we are having these much more extensive chapter summaries, and we're starting now in the way we always have, with Maharaj and I reading and commenting. But what we want is that all of you will take the study guide back
read it along with the chapter from Srila Prabhupada's books, Bhagavatam. And we would like you to look for points either in the study guide itself or something you find in a purport of Srila Prabhupada's that is not mentioned in here that just particularly strikes you, finds you, inspires you. And we would like to humbly invite you then to let us know a day after tomorrow, Thursday, or today already, if you've, because those who are attending yesterday have already heard this. Let us know the point or points that you would like to volunteer to speak on before the class. And this is not like it before when we would ask someone to come and summarize the whole chapter in 20 minutes. No, we're talking about specific points. So your presentation can be as short as, well, we hope not shorter than 5 minutes, you know. We would like to see at least 5 minutes, up to 20 minutes if you really have something to say. But we're very eager to hear your realizations. We'd like to see you do a little research, look into other purports of Srila Prabhupada, other books of Prabhupada, other sources. Compose a little, you know, a few paragraphs and make a presentation. And I spoke how if you're a lady and you're feeling shy, we've already, from our what we've done before, we already know now that we have some very fine leaders among the students like Shanti Parayan Prabhu and David Prabhu. You can go to them and get assistance from them. They can help you in putting together the presentation. They may even present it for you if you feel too shy to do it yourself, if they agree. And in this way, those who volunteer, two things, there's two results. Those who volunteer to make these presentations will be exempt from having to write the essay over the weekend. Those who remain shy wallflowers, all enclosed in your five koshas, then your participation will continue through the essays. So, you see, it's a very nice deal. If you can just come before us for even 5 minutes and speak, then you won't have to write the weekend essay. And another prominent concern from all of you, which was actually initiated by me, by the way I formulated how you should write the essay, was questions and answer period. So yes, we will reserve at least one day at the end of this chapter for questions and answers, which should be written by you, pre-written by you, and handed in. And we will answer as many questions as persons have made presentations. So there are now 18 full-time or part-time enrolled students. So that means Maharaj and I are willing to deal with up to 18 questions, which will certainly take more than one class period. In other words, we're willing, you know, you want time for questions, we're willing to give you 2 or even necessarily 3 days of questions and answers, but it depends on you to make the time by your participation. So if only 3 people have got the nerve to come up and make a presentation, then we're only going to have time for 3 questions at the end of this chapter. If 5, then we'll take 5 questions. If 10, then we'll take 10 questions. If all 18, then we'll have 18 questions. Over, it'll take at least 2 days. So you see, we'll do all these things for you, but you have to do something for us. This is how it's going to work. We want to see, I am especially, this is always, as I always say, this is my particular concern, is I am the aspect of this whole course that I am most concerned with is the development of the Sangha, the association between the devotees of, that we get out. I spoke at length and I checked later. Fortunately, there were not so many devotees here.
So at least those devotees who are here didn't find what I had to say controversial. Although our dear secretary here, Kashishwar, came afterwards. He said, "Are you sure, Maharaj, you want this to be on tape?" Because I did make some remark about the, you know, my concern about the growing prominence of Upadi Buddha consciousness in ISKCON. You know, everyone becoming covered by designations of, you know, whatever. And that becomes their identity. And Upadi Buddha, you know, includes even sannyas, even guru, is just an upadi, a designation. I quoted how Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, the designation of guru is most fit for an asura. That's an actual quote from a lecture that was widely circulated in ISKCON soon after Srila Prabhupada's departure by the GBC. So it's a very authorized source. I'll repeat it. The designation guru is most suitable, most appropriate for an asura. But Vaishnavas take it on as a service to Krishna to help the conditioned living entities advance in Krishna consciousness. That's the only interest Vaishnavas have in accepting that upadhi. Otherwise, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was saying, the whole concept of guru and Vaishnava are like at 180 degree opposite poles. You know? A Vaishnava in his own heart has no interest whatsoever in being a guru, in assuming such a role in society. But it is necessary because of human nature. So I spoke about these things, and I said my purpose in holding, you know, in being involved in this course is really with the sharp, razor-sharp blade, I want to cut through these koshas, that means the coverings of the soul, and get to the real souls that are here. You're all very wonderful souls because you've come to this Krishna consciousness movement. And it will make my satisfaction to see you just come out into the light of Krishna consciousness. And so that all together we can, I was in trouble. So that all together we can relish this treasure of Srimad Bhagavatam that Srila Prabhupada has given us. Prabhupada said, the Bhagavatam is not simply for export business. It's not simply a book to be sold. He wrote this for us. And we can actually achieve this Rasayana Kata that Kapila Dev talks about. The pleasure of tasting the nectar of the Bhagavatam. How? Through Satam Prasanga. Through very nice association. So this is, I'm always maneuvering. And as I said yesterday, we are now entering stage two of my program, and I have further stages in mind, which I will, you know, in a very, observing all the decorum of the, you know, democratic values that have become so prominent in ISKCON today, I will very nicely introduce with your approval and sanction. Yeah, this is Vaishnava Sangha too. And so, as we proceed through the chapters, we're going to be, as to use this American expression from gambling, upping the ante, it's called. You know? What we're going to be asking of you will become more and more and more. But we ourselves are going to also be contributing more and more. And we already have the plays, we already have our boys as the Bhagavata players, and the next play will be the preaching of Vidura to Dhritarashtra and Dhritarashtra's departure from the world. So stay tuned for that. We hope we can do that before we have to break the class at Nityananda Trayodasi. So we are trying to make this course as relishable as possible in so many different ways. So just like the tasting of rasas compared to the mixing of the six different flavors. you see. And Krishna is the most expert rasika, the most expert cook in that sense. So we also want to have this class to be a real experience in rasa in the real sense, you see. Because I, you know, there has been in recent years so much talk of rasika bhakti, but I am 190% convinced that all of it is in Prabhupada's books, and we just have to dive into the nectar. But that means, I'll give you an example. This is a rather, I don't mean to be shocking, but this is an example from Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada said that if a husband and wife, you know, when they really want to get into their amorous relationship, what do? They have to remove all their clothing, all the covering. So if we really want to get into the Srimad Bhagavatam, similarly, we have to remove all the coverings of upadis, all these egotistical ideas of who we think we are, and, you know, the ladder of opportunity. I'll become, you know, deputy GBC, then assistant GBC, then full GBC, then guru, and then at last, avatar. We have to throw all that away, and the soul has to come forth himself, who is the eternal servant of Krishna, and enter into the real Vaishnava Satya, and then we can actually taste the nectar of Bhagavatam. So this is my main concern, and so my concern and Maharaj's concern for the... I mean, I am actually just as concerned as Maharaj about the educational aspect. I hope you can see that from the information that I put into these purports. But I have this special concern to create a very nice sangha, at least here. And this is a very different concept from any other. And please don't take this in the wrong way. I'm not in any way intending to denigrate any other program of education that is now going on in ISKCON. But this is something special that we're doing here. This is a very special approach that's only being done here. It's kind of an experiment, but I'm very gratified to see that there's a lot of interest in it. So the other educational programs, they do have their place, and they're very important, and they're training up preachers for the furtherance of the spreading of Krishna consciousness throughout society. That's very good. But Prabhupada especially wrote these books, he said, for his disciples, so that we can get the taste, the nectar of Krishna consciousness from them. He said, I did not write this Srimad Bhagavatam for export business, just to be sold on the streets. So, anyway, that's the trade-off that we established yesterday. You want time for questions? You can have that. The more you come forward to present your realizations. So from this point on then, you see, this is quite a lengthy document, and it's going to take, you know, if it's just me and Maharaj, yes, we'll read through it and we'll make comments if that's the way it has to be. But things will go much nicer, much sweeter, if you can come forward and take sections, selections from this study guide or other things that you find in your study, your side study of the study guide, and make presentations yourself. And you'll get immense credit for this. You'll not have to write the weekend essay. And we will add up the presentations, and that will equal the number of questions that we will take from you at the end of each chapter. So you see how it's going to work? Okay? And don't worry, just before Nityananda and the Triodicy, we will ask you again to write another feedback essay to see what you think of this. If you think it's working, if it's going, you should continue like that. If you have a problem with it, let us know. We'll try to adjust. We're not trying to force anything down anyone's throat, but we do want to get maximum taste out of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's my special interest in this course. Maximum taste and maximum knowledge. All right? Everyone understand that? Yes? So please take these study guides home. Read them carefully against Srila Prabhupada's chapter 11 of First Canto, And please consider deeply where you can make a contribution. Please come out and contribute to this class, even if it's for just 5 minutes. And let us deepen our sadhu sangha, because then we will really make progress in actually understanding the Srimad Bhagavatam, having it flourish in our own hearts, so that it actually becomes a natural part of our thinking and behavior and speech. We will become Bhagavatas. That's what a Bhagavata is. He is a living representative. He is instinctively representing the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's what we're trying to achieve in this course. Okay? So you have now one day, Wednesday, and Thursday. If any of you already have ideas, please come now at the end of the class and tell us, and we'll note it down and schedule you. But certainly on Thursday, we hope, we pray, we beseech you, we fall at your feet, touching your toes with straws in our mouth. Please, if even for just 5 minutes, volunteer to make presentations on Thursday, and we will make a schedule, and in this way, we will go through this chapter. All right, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.